Hello and welcome to this episode of the In Conversation with eClinical Medicine podcast. I'm Helen Lynn, Senior Editor at eClinical Medicine, part of the Lancet Discovery Science. This month, we're releasing two special episodes to mark the publication of our virtual collection on obesity, which showcases a number of interesting research articles exploring the prevalence and impact of weight bias in healthcare, challenging preconceived ideas about obesity and how it should be diagnosed and managed, as well as highlighting some exciting new and emerging pharmacotherapies for the treatment of obesity. To discuss this important issue further, I'm delighted to say that we're joined by two contributors to the collection, Dr. Stuart Fent and Dr. Sally Abbott. Dr. Abbott is an assistant professor at Coventry University and is the clinical lead dietitian for the obesity service at University Hospitals Coventry and Warwickshire NHS Trust. Her research interests include the uptake and access of treatments for obesity and the nutritional and behavioural implications of significant weight loss. She has worked in bariatric surgery for the past 10 years and holds national positions as the bariatric officer for the British Dietetic Association Obesity Specialist Group and council member for the British Obesity and Metabolic Surgery Society. Dr. Stuart Flint is an associate professor at the University of Leeds, president of Scaled Insights and an honorary academic for the Office of Health Improvement and Disparities. He has a specific interest and expertise in stigma and discrimination, leading work internationally and nationally to highlight the pervasiveness and impact of weight stigma and discrimination. He has developed interventions to reduce stigmatizing attitudes and discriminatory behaviors, working with national and local governments, health systems, education, media, and the general population. Dr. Flint has published widely in high-impact journals, including The Lancet, BMJ, Nature Medicine, and has played an important role in shaping and developing our collection on obesity. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Abbott and Dr. Flint, and welcome to the podcast. To start with, could you tell us about weight bias, what causes it, and what the consequences are? Dr. Abbott, let's start with you.
Yeah, sure. So first of all, thanks for having us on this podcast. So weight bias essentially is the negative weight-related attitudes. It might be assumptions, it might be beliefs or judgments. This is generally towards people living with obesity, but it should be stressed that weight bias can happen across the whole spectrum of weight. In terms of what causes weight bias, in Western society, it's this association between thinness equaling beauty or health or value, whereas obesity having sort of the polar opposite connotation. A lot of the causation of weight bias really is the lack of education around what causes obesity and the implication that somebody's weight, particularly them, they have obesity, is down to their individual choice, which we know just isn't true. In terms of consequences, I mean, it's really far-reaching. The consequences quite the opposite of perhaps that misconstrued belief in society that if we shame somebody because of their weight, that it might motivate them to lose weight, when actually we know this has quite the opposite effect. And we know as well there's sort of the consequences in terms of psychology and mental health, with weight bias leading to anxiety, depression, and disordered eating. But it can also mean that people experiencing weight bias might actually avoid health-seeking behaviours, so they might actually disengage with healthcare systems as a consequence. They may disengage from being active, particularly in public places, because of that shame. But also they might actually engage in disordered eating. And this is because we know that weight bias leads to a stress response in the body. And that stress response as a result of experiencing bias can lead to eating as sort of a coping mechanism for the bias that's been experienced. So, I mean, in terms of consequences, it really is far-reaching in terms of what will happen as a consequence of weight bias, particularly for a person who's living with obesity.
Dr. Flint.
So in the simplest definition, weight bias refers to negative attitudes and beliefs towards people based on body size. And whilst people of all body shapes and sizes experience weight bias, because of the long-standing beauty ideals as well as the often negative and disrespectful depiction of people with overweight or obesity, this means that weight bias is typically directed towards people with a higher weight status. Now, research also tells us that people develop both conscious or often referred to as explicit weight bias, as well as unconscious or implicit weight bias attitudes. Because of the widespread nature of weight bias, as well as the societal importance placed on appearance, people living with overweight or obesity may experience weight bias on almost a daily occurrence and across many different settings, from policy to healthcare. And there are many sources that contribute to the formation and maintenance of weight bias attitudes, including, of course, policy, which may be setting the agenda, the rhetoric and the framing included, that may shape the public health narratives and interventions that we see. Education, which may start with family and friends from an early age, as well as, of course, in schools and other settings, as well as the media and media's portrayal, which is particularly insidious and increasingly accessible through social as well as traditional media sources that are known to portray people living with obesity in a very negative light. Now, what we do know is that weight bias attitudes predict weight discriminatory behaviours, as we have seen increasing reports of weight discrimination in settings such as schools, with bullying, teasing and harassment experienced by children with a higher weight status. In workplaces, from colleagues and managers, where people may be overlooked in the hiring or promotion phase, and of course in healthcare settings where people living with obesity may experience weight bias, irrespective of the reason for attending a care setting, as well as in issues relating to access.
So, Dr. Abbott, your study focuses on the prevalence of implicit weight bias among obesity specialist healthcare professionals and their attitude to non-weight-focused approaches. Dr. Flint has already explained to us what implicit weight bias is, but could you tell us more about the key findings of your study?
Yeah, absolutely. So, as you've said, in our study, we're looking specifically at implicit weight bias. So just to add to what Dr. Finn has said, we have explicit biases. So these are the conscious beliefs that we have. So if we were doing research into explicit weight bias, we might measure this using methods such as surveys and questionnaires. But when we're looking at implicit biases, this is a bit more difficult to measure because we're actually looking for the unconscious automatic beliefs that somebody has. The only way to really measure this in terms of methods is to use a response latency task, like the implicit association test, which is what we used. By doing this, we were asking our participants to match images of different body sizes and shapes with different words that had negative or positive connotations to them. And by doing this and measuring the response times, we were actually able to gauge the severeness of somebody's preference towards thin or to overweight body types. So during this association test, what we actually found is that 51% of our sample of bariatric surgery healthcare professionals had an implicit bias against people living with obesity. And it's really important that we've understood this a little bit more, because this kind of study hasn't been done in bariatric surgery healthcare professionals before. And arguably, these healthcare professionals are dealing with patients with the most complex obesity. So if we think about that 51%, it is lower in terms of the prevalence of implicit weight bias compared to what's been found in other studies for non-obesity specialist clinicians. So, for example, in other studies, around 3/4 of physicians had an implicit bias against people with obesity. So we may feel reassured that this is lower, but actually, when we think about this healthcare professional group is working with a group of patients who've arguably had the most stigmatizing experiences in healthcare, actually, this is really high. So 1 in 2 healthcare professionals working in bariatric surgery services have an implicit weight bias against people living with obesity. And this really shows that no healthcare professional is immune to implicit weight bias. We know that implicit weight bias are the belief systems and attitudes that are unconscious. And actually, for healthcare professionals, these may well have been gained or ingrained in somebody before they even became a healthcare professional. So this was really important that we understood this. What we also did in our study was to explore more qualitatively about how healthcare professionals working in bariatric surgery services felt about the more weight-centric approach that we generally tend to have in healthcare and in bariatric surgery services too. So what we explored with our participants was actually how would they feel if we took less focus on weight and we moved away from that weight-centric approach. And that was really quite interesting because the response quite overwhelmingly is that participants felt that this would have a really positive impact on the healthcare professional and patient relationship. It would lead to perhaps more trust, less shaming, less blaming, and overall improve the healthcare experience for people living with obesity when they are under the care of bariatric surgery services. But on the counter side, there were a lot of barriers and a lot of fear around moving away from this weight approach because there was this uncertainty about what other outcome measures we could actually use as healthcare professionals if we didn't use weight. So really, these findings were really important. It shows that no healthcare professional, even healthcare professionals who are trained and work solely with people living with the most complex obesity, nobody is immune to implicit weight bias.
That's really interesting and, quite shocking findings, really. So, Dr. Fint, your work explores the prevalence and impact of weight bias among healthcare students and in patient-provider interactions. Could you provide us with an overview of the key findings of your work that is included in our collection?
Thanks. And in this study, we explored explicit and implicit weight bias amongst healthcare students in Australia who were attending 39 universities across the country. Now, there's a paucity of research examining weight bias in healthcare students in Australia. And just like elsewhere, they represent the next generation of healthcare professionals who will, given the prevalence of overweight and obesity, be providing care for people with a higher weight status, whether that care is related to a person's weight status or not. So this study took a cross-sectional approach where healthcare students completed an online survey, which was comprised of validated weight bias related measures. And the findings demonstrated that healthcare students in Australia do hold weight bias attitudes. In doing so, this study has highlighted the need for weight bias interventions and improved education about obesity for healthcare students across Australia. So that mirrors what we're seeing in other countries. And this educational training could be provided either through universities or training centres themselves, or possibly through professional organisations. Ideally, it will be a combination of these because, you know, addressing weight bias requires collaborative action.
So you've kind of already alluded to this, both of you, but what are the implications of your findings on the care of patients living with obesity? We'll start with you, Dr. Abbott.
So I guess the implications of the findings from our study is that we know we need targeted interventions for weight stigma and weight bias across the whole of the population. We know that all healthcare professionals do need education and training, but it's really highlighted that even healthcare professionals who are already trained and work exclusively with people with obesity need training and education and interventions too. And that's because that implicit weight bias, which is what we were particularly looking at, is so ingrained in us even before many of us became healthcare professionals that it needs to still be targeted.
And how about you, Dr. Flint?
So the implications of these findings are that the weight bias interventions are needed in Australia amongst healthcare students and trainees. And, you know, without these interventions, you know, we risk the continuation of weight bias experiences in healthcare settings. And this is critically important because weight bias experiences in these settings pose, you know, many different implications from directly being a health risk. So we know, for instance, from the research evidence that experiences of weight bias can have an impact on physical and mental health outcomes, including depression or increased cardiometabolic risk factors or body image, the development of body image concerns. This is just to name a few. And the potential impact that this might have on future healthcare engagement and attendance. And of course, you know, people may well avoid future healthcare because, you know, and quite understandably, it would be a setting that people would want to avoid if it's not deemed as a safe space that's free from judgment and blame, and where healthcare professionals are not perceived to be trustworthy. So it's imperative that everyone, no matter their background or reason for attending healthcare, feels able to do so, and that they will be treated with dignity and respect, and they're confident that they will receive the care, support, and advice that is aligned to their healthcare visit. I think that we would all hope for that. So this should be the same for people, irrespective of body shape or size.
So looking at this issue from a slightly different angle, the World Health Organization, the World Obesity Federation, and the European Commission, as well as many other organizations, all consider obesity to be a chronic disease. If the UK were to accept this definition, what effect do you think this would have on weight bias? Dr. Abbott, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point, actually. The UK is quite far behind other westernized countries in adopting obesity as a disease. I think it was sort of late 1990s, 1997, that the World Health Organization first classified obesity as a disease, and the UK still hasn't got there yet. I think what's quite interesting when we think about this debate about categorizing obesity as a disease is when we think about how healthcare professionals perceive this and how the general public perceive this. So if we look at surveys that have been done, nearly 3/4 of healthcare professionals do feel that obesity is a disease. But when the general public are surveyed, only about 1/3 feel that obesity should be classified as a disease. So there's sort of a sense that perhaps the general public have more resistance to this idea, likely because of a lack of education and an understanding about what actually causes obesity. So in terms of how classifying this obesity as a disease will help with weight bias, it's quite a contentious subject when you talk with professionals working in the field. But overall, there is a sense that classifying obesity as a disease would have a positive impact on weight bias. So we know that 90% of somebody's body mass index is genetically determined, and that very much aligns with the idea that there's a biological driver to obesity that's beyond the control of the individual. And by definition, this is a disease. Classifying obesity as a disease would also help in gaining funding for treatment and prevention of obesity too. So if we think just last year, the government pulled the £100 million of funding for weight management services in England. If you think about the public health budget, only a really small proportion of this is actually spent on weight management and obesity. So if obesity was classified as a disease in the UK, it would gain more traction and attention for gaining funding, as I said, for treating, but also for preventing obesity too. In terms of training and curriculums for medical and other healthcare professionals, classifying obesity as a disease, again, would mean that obesity is mandated to be on curriculums, meaning that healthcare professionals who qualify and practice in healthcare would have a better appreciation and understanding of the biological drivers for obesity. And all of this sort of contributes to the weight bias that we see in healthcare is this lack of education and understanding. So overall, it could have a positive impact. But on the other side of the argument, we have the inaccuracy of how we currently diagnose obesity. So at the moment, we use body mass index, BMI, as a way of arbitrarily saying somebody has obesity or not. But what we also know about BMI is that BMI doesn't always correlate with illness and health when it's used on its own. So it actually runs the risk of categorizing somebody as having obesity and potentially labeling them as having a disease, when actually, if you look at the health markers for that patient, or if you ask them themselves in terms of how they feel about their health, they might say, actually, I feel healthy myself. So in some ways, it may label people as having a disease when the person themselves may actually feel that they're healthy.
And Dr. Kent, what do you think about this issue?
Well, the reality is that we just don't have enough evidence to be able to confidently conclude that recognizing obesity as a disease will lead to a change in weight bias attitudes. The studies in this space are badly needed, and there's no doubt about that, and I would certainly call for more research to be able to give us that evidence. You know, and I feel that we've missed the opportunities to gather such information where countries or regions in the past have made this change and data was not gathered. So, I mean, theoretically, weight bias discrimination should reduce, and access to care that has been shown to be inequitable for people living with obesity should improve, given the legislative implications of recognition and therefore the requirements for healthcare professionals to provide care in a more equitable fashion, as observed with other chronic outcomes that have been recognized as diseases. However, this might lead to, you know, procedural changes, but in terms of changes to attitudes and bias, I feel that there's much greater systemic change that's needed if we are to see, you know, a change in public perceptions. And it's important to say that recognition of disease should be based on whether these, you know, health outcome has a disease pathology, not whether it will lead to a change in weight bias. As much as I want to see weight bias eradicated, that is, of course, my primary goal. It always has been my primary goal and will continue to be my primary goal through my research and applied efforts.
So moving on to something that has been in the UK media recently, recent research indicates that new drugs such as GLP-1 receptor agonists can promote significant weight loss. In the UK, NICE has recently approved the use of semaglutide as a weight loss medication. With such drugs now becoming available to patients, what effect do you think this will have on weight bias? Sorry. Dr. Flint, let's start with you.
So a major issue right now for me is the portrayal of these new pharmacotherapy products to the public, primarily through the media. And most of the traditional media that I have seen have referred to them as weight loss products, with portrayal suggesting people can lose weight rapidly and easily, and that these products, you know, are available for the masses as such. Now, these products should not be portrayed as weight loss products, and if they are to be used, should only be used by people who meet the clinical criteria. The current portrayal, however, both in traditional and through social media, as well as suggestions that, you know, the minor celebrities, for instance, have used these for weight loss, which is not related to obesity. You know, these are, you know, for me, are really concerning, because what we need to avoid is a perception that these should be used by people across the population. There is also a need to improve people's awareness of side effects, just like other pharmacotherapy, which, again, I haven't seen enough of from the media, which, you know, whether we like it or not, is where a lot of public are receiving, you know, information about health and health-related care. So, you know, it's critically important that the media's portrayal is accurate, is fair, and is aligned to the clinical evidence base. And it may also be unhelpful that these products are described for rapid weight loss, and there's a lack of information about the long-term use requirements for sustained weight change. And in fact, a recent study that's just come out has shown that people living with obesity who used semaglutide and ceased using the product regained weight after 12 months. So my feeling right now is that the way that these products are being framed to the public has the potential to have a very negative impact on weight bias, as well as inaccurate perceptions of how, who, and why they might be appropriate aids for some people to use.
Dr. Abbott, do you have anything else to add?
I think this is a really interesting question. And I think, as Dr. Flint has said, the media aren't really helping the cause here in terms of weight bias and GLP-1 therapies, because the portrayal in the media is very much that this is a weight loss drug. And it's not actually a weight loss drug. It does lead to weight loss, that's totally correct, but it's a drug that alters your appetite. So there's some misunderstanding in terms of the portrayal of how this drug actually works. And going on this drug doesn't guarantee weight loss. It's not a drug that will work on its own. It's to be used alongside behavioral and lifestyle changes as well. In terms of the question about how this may influence weight bias, I think we need to think about where we are now versus where we might be in, say, 10 to 20 years from now. So 10 to 20 years from now, when we've got a much better understanding about obesity and different therapies and individualized, personalized treatment for patients with obesity, we will have a better understanding of how to actually make sure that the treatments that we're offering patients are going to be effective. But at the moment, what we know is when patients are put on treatment such as semaglutide, there's still a curve in terms of how patients respond. So not all patients will respond in the same magnitude. So if you put two patients on semaglutide, some patients might lose a great deal of weight. Some patients may lose no weight at all. So if you take two patients, one patient may lose, say, 20% of their body weight, and one person may lose no weight at all. So for somebody who doesn't understand that, that actually the response to this drug will vary depending on the individual, there is actually the potential that this could perpetuate weight bias. So to place blame on that individual that they've taken this drug and they've not lost weight, and putting that responsibility back onto the individual, when actually the therapy that they were put on may not have been well suited for them. So in terms of where we are now, it's interesting in terms of the access that there is to the GLP-1 therapies. So right now you can access semaglutide if you have a BMI of 27 with a comorbidity, if you can pay privately for the prescription. In terms of through the NHS, the funding of semaglutide for the NHS, according to NICE guidance, if you have a comorbidity, your BMI is 35 or above. So people who can pay privately to access these drugs, they can access this at a lower BMI. So in a sense, they are likely to reduce their BMI to what we call the healthy range. Whereas to access it through the NHS, actually your BMI has to be much higher. In terms of how long the drug is actually funded for, so with the NICE guidance, it's given for a maximum of 2 years. What we know about obesity treatment is that when you stop it, it will stop being effective. So if you compare this to a medication such as blood pressure medication, we know that blood pressure medication will lower your blood pressure, but as soon as you stop taking it, your blood pressure will go back up. It's exactly the same with GLP-1. So whilst you're on the GLP-1, it will help to manage your appetite, you will lose weight, but when you stop the drug, you will regain weight. So again, for the public or for healthcare professionals that don't understand this, when somebody stops that drug, inevitably they will experience weight regain. There may be that potential for the individual to be blamed for gaining weight after being on pharmacotherapy as well. But not only are the people having this sort of perspective, the patient themselves, if they've not been counseled correctly that this is likely to happen, may actually blame themselves. And that's when we think about internalized weight bias. So patients thinking that actually they are to blame for putting weight back on after a drug has been stopped. So I'd say in short, we're making progress with treatment for obesity, but where we are in terms of access to these GLP-1 therapies right now, there's a big disparity in terms of who can access them and at what criteria. So actually there is the potential for health inequalities to be exacerbated between people who can afford to pay privately for these prescriptions versus people that can't.
Well, that's really interesting. Thank you for sharing your thoughts on this. So finally, what more do you think needs to be done to tackle weight bias? So Dr. Finch, shall we start with you?
Thanks. And there's so much that needs to be done to tackle weight bias, and it's difficult to suggest only a few actions to take. As I alluded to earlier in this podcast, what I feel we need is systemic change from top to bottom. And that means changes to policies in the approach, the framing and associated actions in healthcare to ensure that people, irrespective of body shape or size, have access to, equitable care in schools, given the weight-related bullying and harassment is now the most common reasons that children experience bullying-related incidents. There's a real need to to address what's happening in schools and education centres. You know, and that might be through, for instance, anti-bullying policies or other. And in the media, with both traditional and social media, evidence is disseminating weight bias information and potentially inciting discriminatory behaviour. So much of these actions, you know, there's clearly a need to improve the public's knowledge about the factors that contribute to, you know, our weight status, and that's all of us, as well as the need to eradicate weight bias. Now, despite the wealth of evidence, however, and there's so much evidence now that shows the complexity of course, obesity, but, you know, the complexity of all the factors that contribute to all of our weight statuses and health outcomes. You know, I really feel that the public have a limited understanding of those factors, both, you know, the factors that are within our control as individuals, as well as those factors that are outside of our control, or at least partially outside of our control. And what I feel is really lacking in terms of obesity is empathy and compassion, which, you know, I really think has been lost, whether it's through policy or healthcare or many other actions within society. This has been pushed by some sources more than others, with the media continually, despite the evidence base showing that weight bias has a negative impact, asking the question to the reader or to the viewer, you know, can weight bias have a positive effect? And there are still politicians, for instance, who make these claims or suggestions, again, which is not aligned to the evidence base. So just to conclude, from my perspective, what we need is evidence-informed information to be disseminated to the public. This should also, of course, include information about the impact of weight bias experiences. And in doing so, I feel this can help to rediscover some of the empathy and compassion that I feel is really missing across many settings within society.
Thank you, Sharon. And Dr. Avil, what do you think?
So I completely agree with what Dr. Flint said. I think this needs to come from the top down, but it also needs to come from the bottom up, and we need to meet somewhere in the middle. I think it's what's really interesting about weight bias is it seems to be the last almost socially acceptable form of bias that we have in society. So, for example, if you think about the Discrimination Act, weight isn't a discriminating factor that people are protected against. So almost as Dr. Finn said, this does need to come from the top. It needs to be set out that this is not acceptable, and that everybody, whether they live with obesity or not, should be treated with dignity and respect and not experience discrimination. I think the only other thing that I would add is that we also need to be very mindful about people who themselves are living with obesity, have an internalized weight bias about themselves. And this is because the years and years of inflicted biases from other people that ultimately they feel that they are to blame and they are responsible for having obesity. And when I think about the patients we see in bariatric surgery services, there's often this sort of conception of among our patients that they don't deserve to be healthy, or they don't deserve access to healthcare and to have treatment for their obesity and have the same opportunities as people who don't live with obesity. So I guess it's just being mindful that it's not just the weight bias that is being portrayed by other people against people living with obesity. Actually, the impact that has on people living with obesity is that weight bias is very much internalized. And that's really difficult to then try and unpick and to treat as well.
Thank you very much again, Dr. Flint and Dr. Abbott, for joining us and for sharing your thoughts and insights into this really important topic. And thank you, listener, for listening to this episode of In Conversation With. Remember, you can subscribe to In Conversation With eClinical Medicine wherever you usually get your podcasts.